Hi, readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. Kate Reed Petty is an essayist, filmmaker, and co-author of the middle grade graphic novel, Chasma Nights. Her debut novel, True Story, is part psychological thriller, part fever dream, and part timely comment on sexual assault, power, and the very nature of truth. Ingeniously constructed and full of twists and turns that will keep you guessing until the final pages, it marks the debut of a singular and daring new voice in fiction. Now, let's join author Kate Reed Petty in conversation with her editor, Lindsay Schwari.
Hi, Kate. It's so good to be with you virtually and to see you.
Hi, Lindsay. It's so good to see you.
So this is Lindsay Schwari, senior editor at Viking, and I'm here with Kate Reed Petty, the author of True Story, which went on sale from the date we're recording last Tuesday, August 4th, I believe. Mm-hmm. So Kate, how are you doing? How is having the first week on sale under your belt?
Oh, thanks. I'm good. I'm really happy to be doing this podcast and interviewing with you today, Lindsay. This feels like a real treat. The week was really good. You know, I think one highlight, I got to go, one of my local bookstores, Ivy Bookshop here in Baltimore where I live, had put a stack of the book in the window. So they're doing like social distancing. I think actually they're doing appointments where you can go and book like your own half hour window to browse through the bookstore. So I want to do that. But for now, I feel like window shopping is kind of my bookstore fix right now. So it felt good to go see the book through the window.
That must be such an amazing feeling.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the things that like, I mean, I just miss bookstores in general. It's like one of the things that I'm really sort of missing during quarantine. And sort of getting to see your own book on a shelf, I think is definitely a dream for authors. So it was really cool to see it on some kind of a shelf.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad you had that opportunity. Yeah, I feel like the first experience is sort of when you open that first package of the finished books, which usually is about a month before the book is out in the world, and then it's like seeing it in the wild. So
yeah, glad you got to
have that experience. So as we sort of start talking about the book itself, I think it would probably be good, Kate, if you just gave our listeners sort of a quick summary, sentence or two, what is this book about?
Totally. So I loved it. What I usually tell people is that this book starts with the rumor of a sexual assault that happens at a high school lacrosse party in the late 90s in suburban Maryland, which is where I grew up. And it's a rumor that then, the sort of hijinks at the party get swept under the rug, the charges get dropped really quickly, but the rumor itself and the story affects four people for the next 15 years. And the book, as it follows those characters through those 15 years, it also kind of changes between different perspectives and also switches genre. So it plays with horror and noir. There are kind of found documents like screenplays and college application essays sprinkled throughout.
I think that's a pretty good summary. I mean, it's a book you really have to read to believe, honestly, because, you know, what you just mentioned sounds so complex, but I think in my experience of first reading the book and the incredible response from booksellers, and everybody within Penguin, is really just how this book is such an incredible page turner and that you sort of can't put it down until you get to the end. And it has this incredibly sort of I don't want to give anything away, but it's quite an ending that really lands and that makes you be like, wow. And I think it's sort of incredible that a book that has so many different elements and is sort of, you know, very, very, I think, political and engaging with important contemporary issues is also this page turner. So it's a super unique read. And I wanted to start by asking you to talk a little bit about the title of the book. I love the title and I love that trickiness and tension of True Story, a novel.
Yeah.
But I think when you actually read the book, you love it even more because you see that it interacts in all these, you know, complex and fascinating ways with the story itself. So could you speak a little bit to how that True Story sort of plays out against,
No, I love the title too, and I'm so glad that we landed on it. It feels like it's one of those titles that the more I think about it, the more it feels so like there's just so many layers to it, and it works in really different kind of ironic ways. I think the first thing I was trying to remember when you and I were first talking about the title and like how did we sort of agree that like trying True Story on and kind of feeling it, and I remember realizing that it sounds like something one of the lacrosse bros would say. Like it sounds like somebody being like True Story, bro, which is not, which immediately makes you not believe the story that this bro is about to tell you. So I really like that layer of it. And then I think it's I think it's just, you know, I think titles are so important and so difficult to kind of hit with any book or movie. And True Story really just hits exactly on the kind of what the core of this book is about, which is like, what is a true story and how do the stories that we kind of accept as true or that we accept as fact shape our lives, and how do we sort of agree on what the truth is when that's kind of malleable and difficult as we're seeing so much in society, especially today. So.
Yes, absolutely. And that's something actually, you know, I thought about how the book related to, you know, current affairs as I had been, you know, editing the book and then was actually on maternity leave and the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings happened. Mm. And there were these crazy parallels between that, certain aspects of, because your book is set in suburban Maryland in part, or at least the sort of high school section, and there were all these parallels. And so it felt really sort of ripped from the headlines. But as we're talking about this now, I think the whole question of what is truth and the subjective nature of truth and the way truth is manipulated, distorted, is another way that the book is incredibly, incredibly timely.
There was this great, I don't know if I sent it to you, there was a great essay that Rebecca Solnit wrote in the New York Times right after Harvey Weinstein was convicted. So this would have been April or March, I want to say. But she talked about how like that power, like as much as Weinstein's abuses were horrific, there's also the way that he and people like him have the power to shape the truth, to silence people, to, you know, get juries to not convict, to get hire private investigators, to kind of influence journalists. Like there's this sort of insidious power structure that literally reshapes the truth. And she talked and she connected that to so many different kind of issues in society. And I think it's I hope that we're starting to figure out how to really listen around those and kind of break down that power. But it's really important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a way in which this novel, and I'm going to try to say this without giving anything away, but involves a reclamation of that voice on the part of the person who is not the empowered party as a result of this rumor and these events. And that's one thing I love about it so much. But
well
let
navigated
me ask you
also.
Another. Sorry?
Well navigated. Around the
yes,
spoilers.
Thank you. Thank you. But anyway, I could just praise this book endlessly. That's not the point of this podcast. So another question for you, very connected. Speaking of Harvey Weinstein, I mean, you told me early on and, you know, I think our first conversation and, you know, that you'd been working on this book for, tell me how many years.
So it's 5 years, 5.5 years now. Yeah.
So years before, you know, Me Too had started, but Me Too had, you know, erupted and taken hold. But that even when you would describe it to people at the outset of your process, that they would say, oh, that sounds so timely. And I guess I wondered, you know, in the years prior to Me Too, what was it that led you to want to write about these issues?
It's sort of horrible to joke about it, but there is something almost kind of absurd about how when you talk about some really upsetting issues, it seems like there's sort of a perennial return to the news where these issues are so timely. And that definitely happened, where there would always be some kind of high profile sexual harassment or sexual assault or rape case that was in the news that people were thinking of when this came up. And it's a weird kind of deja vu that it happens again and again, and every time feels like so upsetting and so shocking. And then with the next time we get kind of worn down. I think, you know, I wanted to write about this because it's something I've been sort of angry about for a long time. You know, it's something that, you know, since definitely in high school, in a really, you know, serious way in college, like sort of throughout my 20s, these things have kept coming up and make me so upset with the way that not only, you know, the perpetrators of sexual assault sort of are let off the hook, but the way that society and the news and so many different kind of forces tend to silence and blame and kind of shut down the victim's power in a lot of cases. And with this book, I wanted to, I mean, I had been trying to write about that injustice for a long time. And with this book, the thing that cracked it open for me was telling it through different voices and different genres and thinking about getting to the story through this eyes of bystanders and friends and people who are touched but not directly involved and looking at how they wrestle with it, because I think that's sort of the heart of where rape culture kind of works in a lot of ways. It's sort of how everybody is touched by it and has a role in it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fragmentary, you know, nature of the book, I mean, the fact that it's narrated from multiple perspectives, you know, it delves into, as you mentioned earlier, different genres, including horror, noir. It has these found documents that are incorporated, the screenplays and the emails, and that all, I think it's fascinating the way that kind of formally drives at this, these same questions.
Yeah. I think it's sort of mirrors the way I say sometimes that when a sexual assault case gets kind of breaks into the news, it's, and you mentioned Kavanaugh, I think that was a really good example, because at one point he produced his calendar, right? There was like this other kind of friend who was in the room, but then was hiding at this, at a vacation house somewhere. The way that like all of the different pieces of testimony and evidence were kind of cobbled together, it was really clear that, and Christine Blasey Ford did such an incredible job of sort of knowing the neuroscience and her own personal experience and had such a clear idea about the limits of her testimony and gave such a compelling testimony, and it still wasn't enough. And I think that like the truth is fragmentary. The things, the way that we experience everything in the world, we can never really know the entirety of things, and we always rely on everybody's testimony and different pieces to pull together. And so I wanted the book to reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it does very successfully. But I wonder too, and maybe I've asked you this once or twice in the past, but were there particular works of fiction that you really admire that you feel like gave you permission to kind of just really go for it and write in different genres and then tie it all up into this really compelling whole? Are there certain books that made you think, oh, it's sort of possible to really go out on a limb?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, A Visit from the Goon Squad, the Jennifer Egan book, is one that I love and one that made me feel that I could push that kind of boundaries of kind of dramatic character and perspective and time and setting shifts and sort of trust the reader to follow along. Cloud Atlas is the other sort of big touchstone for me, David Mitchell's book, which if readers don't know, kind of similarly switches genre from chapter to chapter or from section to section. And that's such a, it's like, it's one of those books that everybody that I recommend it to loves it. It's sort of a complete crowd pleaser. So that definitely gave me confidence that I could trust readers to follow me across these big leaps and sections that change perspective and style kind of dramatically. But I think I did also, I mean, I really appreciate the compliment that the book is a page turner, because I love page turners and I wanted to write one. But I think also the pressure of knowing that it was kind of an unusual structure made me really want to be sure that I was hooking readers after each change too. Like, if we're going to be in an entirely new world with a new character, something exciting has to happen right away. And that has to serve the overall story, but I really want people to stick with me. So
I was astounded by your ability to bring so much tension and such a sense of stakes, even into these situations where it wasn't exactly clear immediately what the stakes were. You just felt like, oh, something's sort of around the bend. But to go back to what you said about those other, the books that inspired you, I think it's interesting you mention David Mitchell, because I've always felt in reading him that he has this ability for ventriloquism to take you inside this this voice and this perspective, like if it's Jacob de Zoet, or something like that. And just the kind of historical precision. And in any case, it kind of connects with something I wanted to ask about your book, which is that I know that you've worked in the past as a ghostwriter. And when we meet Alice, who is the young woman at the center of this rumored assault, when we meet her as an older woman, you know, in her 30s, like me, she's working as a ghostwriter. So I wanted to just hear a little bit about, why you wanted to bring that into the novel, what you yourself sort of learned as a ghostwriter, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I do. I really, it's so funny when I, all the time I spent working at a ghostwriter, I kind of felt like I was kind of stumbling my way through, but looking back, I'm really grateful for the practice it gave me with, used the word ventriloquism, which I really love. It feels like that, I know a lot of writers feel like they want to kind of preserve their writing brain as much as possible, and they want their day job to be something completely different. But I always, for me, it really worked as like a kind of cross training, just the practice with taking on completely people's completely different voices and stories, and kind of figuring out how to, throw my voice a little bit, to use that metaphor. It was really interesting thinking about that in the context of this book too, because, you know, as a ghostwriter, my process, I would, similarly to Alice in the book, do phone interviews with clients. So I would be on the phone with somebody for an hour or a couple of hours over the course of days and weeks. And I would sort of type down everything that they say and ask questions and kind of draw their stories out. And then, you know, turn that into a blog post or a TED talk or a web copy or whatever else they needed. And so it's really interesting. I think I'm just sort of fascinated by that way. And I think we all do this kind of in our lives, on social media, we do this for like applying for a job, but how we kind of figure out how to make our messy lives into a story that we want to show to the public. And so, you know, the work made me think about the difference between kind of the personal story and the public story. And, you know, as a ghostwriter, I think that also helped me figure out how to make that public story really compelling. So that contributes to the like sense of tension that you were talking about. Thank you. But I think also what I really want to look at with this book is the way that, like, what are the things that get cut out in that process? What are the pieces that we decide are not fit for public consumption, and why? And what do we lose through that process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just one of the many ways that this book is ultimately a book about storytelling, although it's much more entertaining than that would maybe make it sound to some. I mean, do you have, of all the different sections in the book, all these different narrative approaches, the two different narrators that we have in the book, is there one section that is sort of your favorite, your pet?
Oh yeah. I mean, it changes for sure. And I was just reading, there's a section that takes place in a cabin in the woods that I was just reading recently, and I was sort of caught myself enjoying it, which you don't normally do with your own book after so many years. But my favorite is probably the college application essay section, which I think we've mentioned a little bit. It's a character in college or in high school trying to write her college application essay, and in the book you see all of her multiple drafts of that essay. And so you kind of see her going through that process I just mentioned of trying to refine her story and figuring out what she wants to cut out. I think it might be, it sounds sort of pretentious to say it's like the most challenging section of the book, but it's definitely sort of, it can throw readers for a loop. And so it means a lot to me when that section speaks to somebody and when they sort of see the heart at the center of it, because I also think it's the most, I think it's a really emotional section and a really heartbreaking section too. So I love that one.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, when I first read that section for sure, and I think every subsequent draft, I cried reading that section. And I think it's just, you know, it is metafictional in terms of, you know, you're reading these different versions of the character's college essay, but you're also seeing her teacher's comments, and you see the way, once again, like a story is being shaped, and in this case, a story of a young woman whose truth maybe is too hard for, you know, an admissions officer to take, but you see her kind of being boxed in and being, contained and made into this sort of smaller version of herself. And it's really sort of heartbreaking, even though you have this well-intentioned teacher in the margins with her smiley faces and that kind of thing. So I always really loved that section. And speaking of the section, you know, with the cabin in the woods, I mean, horror plays a big role in this book. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your relationship to the genre. I think you and your brother made some home movies when you were a kid that partly inspired some of these sections, and maybe you can say a little something about the movie if there's anything.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
If you're allowed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I will for sure. I feel like the first thing I should say, or I've been thinking about when horror comes up, is that I don't know if maybe you can correct me, Lindsay, if you disagree, but I don't think it's too scary for people who don't like horror novels. I think it's definitely a little bit creepy, but it's not like I always want to apologize to horror fans because I want to be like, this is not actually going to scare you like the way that you might expect it to.
No. And honestly, I mean, when I say horror, I don't have the most precise understanding of genre because I mainly work on literary fiction and books that sort of cross between genres. And I would say it's in some ways it's really suspense, you know, it's a more suspenseful brand of horror.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it's not blood and guts or anything.
I just feel like I want to tell people I've had to reassure a few family members that it's not too scary for them. So I want to reassure readers, it's not too scary. But I did want to, I mean, I think I do love horror movies, even as a scaredy cat, and I love horror novels. Novels I feel a little bit more contained with, more safer with movies. I do sort of watch them through my fingers sometimes, but I think it's really exhilarating to look at the sort of worst things that we can imagine and to do it within this kind of safe structure of a story. Like you sort of know, even though you know a horror movie is going to scare you, you kind of know the rules of the genre and you kind of know that it's going to upset you in a way that you're somewhat prepared for and can somewhat digest afterwards. So in True Story, in this book, you know, Alice, the main character, loves horror, and it's sort of like a childhood, you know, since she's very little, she loves horror. But as she sort of goes through different traumas in her life and grows up, it becomes this way that it's almost like a kind of paradoxically, it's almost kind of like a safe haven for her to kind of escape into horror or to tell her stories through horror. But her sort of childhood fandom, so there are some like movies that she and her best friend Haley make early on in the book that are sort of kid version of horror movies. And those were taken from movies that my big brother and I used to make when I was a kid. I should say my big brother made them and I acted in them. I like, he like told me what to do and I ran around screaming. That was like a very, it was like such a fun creative experience of my own childhood. And I wanted to sort of show some of Alice's early pure creative voice through those horror movies that are included. More recently, I will say my brother and I so he now makes horror movies and he's a really talented and accomplished screenwriter. And we wrote it's kind of a horror bank heist that we wrote together, a movie script. I shouldn't give it away, but it's sort of like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that takes place in a bank heist. So it's this married couple who are just like fighting viciously, like cannot stop bickering, cannot stop like undermining each other. And they're also directing a team of bank robbers to like take a bank hostage and steal $15 million. So that has been winding its way through this, you know, through the long, long process of movie making. But we do have J.K. Simmons, who's the amazing, talented actor from Whiplash, is signed up to play a detective. So keep your fingers crossed that it'll come through. Yeah,
I was gonna say I can only, it sounds amazing, and I can only hope that for many, many reasons besides this one that COVID doesn't bar something like that from happening. So I hope they'll be able to actually make movies again soon, among many other things. Okay, so last question about the book. Now, when you taking a step back, the book coming out, how do you feel about sort of where Alice ends up at the end of the book? And, you know, if your characters sort of live for you this way in your mind, how would you sort of picture her, where we leave her in the book, where, how would you picture her life sort of going forward from there?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good question. It's sort of, it's difficult to define. But I think that like I've had people ask if it's, you know, a happy ending or if it feels sort of hopeful at the end. And I think about, there's that Grace Paley short story, A Conversation with My Father, where she's like arguing with her father about how to write a story and how to end it. And she sort of keeps trying to make a joke or give the characters a happy ending. And her dad is like, no, you have to look at tragedy in its face. And so I sort of feel like embarrassed about too happy of an ending because it feels like things don't end, you know, or I think nothing sort of finishes. But I think with Alice, I think that I gave her like a sense of power at the ending. I think that she ends the book with agency and power that she didn't start it with. And so I think that's a kind of optimism. So I think that's the most honest way that I think you can end a book like that. Well,
absolutely. I agree with that 100%. Great. Well, it's so fun to chat with you about the book.
This is a and, joy.
Before we close, you know, for the Books Connect Us podcast, I know, you know, the Books Connect Us initiative started, I think, among, you know, PRH employees just sharing things they were reading during the pandemic and became this hashtag and on this podcast. And it's a great time for people to share reading recommendations. And I'm curious what you've been reading and what's been sort of either distracting you, sustaining you, you know. During the pandemic.
Yeah, it's a great question. I hope I can hear one or two from you as well, maybe. But I will say that, you know, there's a book that has meant a lot to me that I just picked up recently. And I was just thinking, because the anniversary of Toni Morrison's death, I think, was last week. It was fairly recently. And I was going back to this book of literary criticism that she wrote called Playing in the Dark, that is about, it's a little bit about genre, and it's a little bit about how basically white authors in American literature have avoided race in their work and avoided the issue of slavery and sort of Jim Crow and the original sin in America, while it's sort of creeping into their stories in the same way. So she looks at like Moby Dick, and she looks at Huckleberry Finn, and just looks at all these books in a really interesting way. So that's one that has meant a lot to me. And then I was also just recently reading, I'm like a year late, but Valeria Luiselli's The Lost Children Archive, which is just an amazing book and highly recommend to anybody. It's like it's a really bold, kind of formally inventive book that again deals with really urgent issues and does so in a way that just kind of blows my mind. So.
Well, I might not have shared a recommendation, but since you mentioned Toni Morrison, I actually am reading Beloved now. Have never read it before, so major gap in my reading, and it is incredibly powerful, gorgeously written, and I think just an incredible. I mean, I almost don't feel equal to putting words to it, but I think the depiction of life in the aftermath of being enslaved and how you can and can't move forward from that trauma, and how an enslaved person coped in order to survive that. It is a really powerful depiction of that, among many other things. And it's just sort of mind blowingly good. So, yeah.
I love that book. That's so cool. Yeah.
So good. Well, great, Kate. It's been so, so wonderful to connect with you and have this opportunity to talk about your book to the lovely Books Connect Us audience.
Yeah, this was a real treat. Thank you so much for making the time, Lindsay, and for your good questions.
And now, here's an exclusive excerpt from the audiobook, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio.
Draft 1. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me, but I'm not supposed to write about when I was raped. And I just did. Shoot. Draft 2. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. My tutor, Miss McCaughey, says not to worry too much. The prompt doesn't really matter. How the heck do you write a good essay based on a question that doesn't matter? It kind of reminds me how everyone says, "How are you?" but they don't really mean it. People ask me how I am all the time, but they don't actually want to know. Probably because they suspect I'm probably not all that great after my accident, which, haha, I'm not supposed to write about either. Draft 3. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me. My tutor, Ms. McCaughey, suggested I start writing and see what comes out. So, ranch dressing and Swiss cheese, Michael Stipe, lampadoodle, freak out, hang 10, power down, whistle stop, cry for help. Game over, try again. Draft 4. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me. To help me think of a good topic, my mom bought me a book of sample college essays to read through. They were all freaking terrible. In one of them, a guy who wants to be an engineer writes about the time he took the family microwave apart. In another one, this girl goes through the etymology of a bunch of interesting words that have been important in her life, because she found words so interesting and wanted to be an English major. In the worst essay of them all, another girl talks about the time her mom took her on a very, very, very special shoe shopping trip. All of them made me feel like a monster. Draft 4.5. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me. One such experience was the time I took the family microwave apart. The impact was that it exploded. The end. Draft 4.75. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me. I think the word impact is really interesting. I looked it up in the thesaurus because that's more interesting than starting an essay with a dictionary definition. The synonyms for impact are 1. Effect, influence, consequences, or 2. Crash, smash, bump. It's interesting to think about how that second one applies to my life. So here's a short list of some crashes and bumps in my life. When I was 8 years old, Gretchen Langloth pushed me off the swing set. The impact was 2 bones in my elbow against the ground. My cast was hot pink. Everyone wanted to be my friend the next day. By the end of recess, there was no pink left on the cast. It was covered in Sharpie signatures. That was the last time in my life that I felt popular. When I was 10 years old, I was the only girl on the baseball team, and I made contact with the ball during a game one time. I hit a double. The impact was my heart exploded. My feelings have been in a million pieces ever since. When I was 12 years old, I snuck out of my bunk at camp and swam across the lake. Because my friend Madeline had chickened out, there were 2 boys waiting for me on the other side, so I had both my first and second kiss in the same night. The impact was the slap of our lips. The first boy, especially, kissed too hard. When I was 14, they found a serial killer in the neighborhood next to mine. They found him out because his wife was in a dumpster cut into 15 pieces. I couldn't figure out where you would cut a body to make 15 pieces. The husband told the police that a burglar had broken into the house and kidnapped her. Later, they found out he had told the same story in a different state about a different cut-up wife. I tried to be a lesbian after that, but couldn't do it. I kept chasing boys. And then when I was 16, 2 boys took advantage of me in the back of a car after a party. And everyone at my school knew about it. And they were so mean to me about it, I basically wanted to die. A month later, I had an accident where I almost did die. I drank a lot of vodka both times. I was unconscious when they both happened. So I don't actually know the impact of either one. If a tree falls in the forest and you're passed out, does it have an impact? I guess the impact was these wads of wet toilet paper Tanya Simpson used to throw at me in the hallway back when I was still in school. They'd stick to the lockers above my head with a sound like crash, smash, bump, or more specifically, schlop. An accident, she said, when one of them hit me in the face. I guess the impact was my dad breaking the window of the car where I was sitting in the driver's seat after I took too much Tylenol. An accident, he said. An accident. Draft 4.9999. For this college application essay, I'm supposed to write about a significant experience that's had an impact on me. But what does significant mean anyway? My thesaurus says, of consequence, uncommon, momentous. Momentous is a strange word. It should mean full of moments, since usually a word ending in us means a thing that is full of itself, like nervous is full of nerves, or how sandwichius is full of sandwiches, Alysius is full of Alice. And what does it mean to be full of Alice? It means you have boring, straight brown hair that only looks okay if you blow dry it. It means you wear a ponytail most of the time and wisps of hair fly out over both of your ears and make you look like you're wearing a weird pilgrim's hat. It means you're pretty good at physics, but you really love writing. It means you want to be a journalist when you grow up. It means your goal is to go to the University of Virginia. Your mom took you to visit, and you saw people lying on blankets reading Joan Didion in the sun on the grass, and they looked like they could be your friends. It means you've been working so freaking hard this year, as hard as anyone has ever worked. You dropped out, but then you went back and completed junior year with summer courses at the community college, and even brought up your GPA. You're working on your GED. You're proving you are UVA ready. You are ready for all of the acronyms. ALICEOUS. Artistic, lovable, intelligent, creative, elegant, original, unique, smart. It means your fifth grade drama teacher cast you as Grisabella in Cats, but another girl came on stage to sing Memory instead of you because you can't sing. It means wolves are your totem animal. It means you love horror movies. Does that sound weird? It's true, though. I really love horror movies. My favorite is The Silence of the Lambs. But I will watch any horror movie, and I won't close my eyes. I've seen the scariest ones, like Seven and The Shining and The Blair Witch Project, and even the really awful ones like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The worst I ever saw was The Last House on the Left, which was just awful. You might think that one is a weird one for me to watch because it's a rape revenge film, but it was my friends on the horror fangirls message board who convinced me to watch it, and they're all survivors of sexual assault too, so I figured. Oh, wait, okay, new try.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.